So we started a new book this week, and the book is the book of Shemot. Shemot is, I never plan on saying this, but I always end up saying this. Shemot is a terrible name for the book. It's a book of Geulah. It is a book of redemption. Although the Jewish idea of redemption probably is a little different from what we normally would think. Because if redemption only means leaving Egypt, so then say for Shemot should probably end someplace around the 13th, 14th, 15th chapter at the most. Because that's it. They're out. They're gone. And there's a lot more, and it goes on like through 40 chapters. So apparently there's a lot more to the redemption than simply this geographical move. And for the other part, if it really is a book of redemption, so apparently Matan Torah is a part of that. But even if Matan Torah is a part of it, so that only takes us up through chapter 24 or so. And the rest of the book, from chapters 25 onward, deal with, on the one hand, the building of the Mishkan, on the other hand, of the Chet HaEgel. This leads the Ramban to understand that the idea of the Geula is one of a spiritual sense, and Geula really means the Shekhinah being in its proper place. And that's really, it's Geulat HaShekhinah. As much as we would think it's Geulat Am Yisrael, it's really Geulat HaShekhinah. And when Yaakov goes down into Galut, one of the things that Yaakov is told is that, you know, when you go, I will go with you. So that leads us to this understanding that Chazal tell us that not only do the Jews go into exile, but somehow the Shekhinah goes into exile as well. So I want to talk about the redemption from Egypt today, because really, you know, Parshat Shemot and going on for the next couple of weeks, at least until chapter 13, 14 or so, deal with leaving Egypt. So I want to talk about the actual leaving of Egypt. And there's two elements that I want to try to get to today, two elements I want to address. And those elements, I think, are what we can... There may be something counterintuitive to both of these elements. One of them maybe you wouldn't think is counterintuitive, even though I do, and maybe the other one... Actually, maybe you'll disagree with me on both, but I will try to make a good case for it. One, there is a passage in the Gemara which I presume you're familiar with or have heard some way, you know, someplace. You don't have this in front of you. It's a Gemara in Masechet Sota on page Yud, Daf Yud Aleph Amid Bet. The Gemara there says, Darash Rav Avira... that because of the Nashim Tzadkaniyot, because of the righteous women, the Jews were saved in Egypt. Now, the Gemara actually goes into some detail, telling us exactly what it thinks, what are examples of this. And it could be that if you have been Jewish women for a long enough time, going to Jewish classes, going studying, it could be that when you read something like this, you accept it 100%, or it could be that when you read something like this, you say, oh, this is more apologetic, so they want to throw the women a bone and say, okay, you know, women have something to do with Judaism, otherwise we may not feel happy at all. So does this actually have any textual basis to it? Which means the idea that Nashim Tzadkaniyot, you know, where in the world do we see such a thing? So if you pay attention to the first two chapters of Shemot, there's actually, other than Moshe, who's being acted upon, there's really no men involved. Yes, there are names of the men, and hence the book Shemot. We have the names of the Shvatim, but if you look really through it, the Jews are scheduled for genocide, and you have the Mieldot, you have Moshe's mother, you have Moshe's sister, you have Paro's daughter. Which means you do have all of these feminine characters to it, and you just really don't have any men involved in it. So when Chazal come and say, oh, it's because of the Nashim Tzadkaniyot, there's absolutely 100% what I would say textual basis for this concept which is spelled out by Chazal. Chazal actually are interesting in the way that then they go spell it out themselves. Instead of pointing at all the things that I pointed at, they tell a story instead of the women taking care of their husbands who were slaves. And I'll just read you a little bit over here. שבשעה שהולכות לשאוף מים, מזמן להם הקדוש ברוך הוא דגים קטנים בכדיהם, ושאובות מחץ המים, מחץ הדגים, ובאות ושוטפות שתי קטירות, אחת של חמין ואחת של דגים, ומלכין אותו לצבלים, לסדר, מחיצות אותם, וסחות אותם, מאכילות אותם, ומשקות אותם, ונזכות להם בין שבתיים, שנאמר, and so on, which means it's basically spelling out that the men were slaves, and women were doing all of these actions, all of these behaviors, in order to help them. There's also later on in the Chumash, we have a little bit of attention when it comes to the mirrors which were being donated. And remember, anybody have any memory of this? The mirrors which were donated for the Mishkan, that Moshe had hesitation about it. According to Rashi, quoted in the Midrash, you know, these mirrors were used by women for unholy things, to make themselves look beautiful and so on. So why would a place like the Mishkan contain this? And God says to Moshe, stop it. Women making themselves look beautiful is absolutely something which is holy, and there's nothing unholy about that. And he goes on to say is that when the men may not necessarily had interest in their wives because of the slavery itself, which was so overwhelming physically, emotionally, and so on, that the women went out and they did all they could to make themselves attractive. So again, you can say this is a very self-serving, male-oriented midrash, but I think it does nonetheless fit into this general theme of the Nashim Tzadkaniyot. There is another minor character or two. Well, one minor character that I have in mind who is not mentioned at all within the text over here, but is mentioned in various midrashim. So I do want to give her a little bit of credit, and then we'll get up to the main thing that I wanted to talk about. The woman's name is Serach Bat Asher, and she's mentioned both in the mid. Why, you know her? But not Bat Asher. Okay. So Serach Bat Asher is Asher's daughter, and she shows up a number of times, and again, it's just interesting when and where she shows up. According to Medrash Rabbah, and this is mentioned also in Tanchuma, and there's also a Tosefta, it says that, I want to go in order. Let me do this in order. So what I'm quoting now is not those other sources. I'm quoting instead something which is found in Pirkei Elazar and the Yalkut Shimoni. It says that when Moshe came, and maybe we'll talk about this a little bit next week, but when Moshe stands by the snare, he has a great deal of hesitation. Will the people believe me, and what will I say, and so on, and God says, this is what you should say, and they'll believe you. So Moshe goes and says it, and he shows the signs, wonders, whatever. So it says then that Moshe showed the signs, said God remembers you, God is going to come and redeem you, and it's so the Midrash says that they didn't know what to do. All the men didn't know what to do. So they came to a woman named Serach Bat Asher, literally Sarah, the daughter of Asher, and she was apparently, the Midrash doesn't say this, I'm adding this in, she was apparently the Gadol Hador. And they come to her and they say, here's this guy, he did these things, he said these things, you know, he did these miracles, what should we do? So she says, we're not impressed with miracles and signs and wonders. Now, that itself is absolutely a bona fide Jewish understanding that we don't get impressed by things like this. And by the way, I would add, especially in Egypt, which has all kinds of magicians and so on, so we're not impressed when it comes to miracles and so on. So then they say to her, and he said, "Pakod pakadati," that God says, I'm going to come, I'm going to redeem them, I remembered them, and so on. She said, hold it a second. If he said that, that means he's the Redeemer. So over here we have, in the middle of this whole story, the Midrash sees it right to stick Serach Bat Asher into the story. Second thing, when the Jews were about to leave Egypt, the Midrash says, now it's all the other ones I just mentioned from Midrash Rabbah through through the Tanchuma and others, it says that when the time came to leave Egypt, all the Jews were busy looking for the biza, right? They were looking for all the valuables in Egypt. So they went to their neighbors and borrowed things and so on. By the way, we can also ask, you know, how this worked out for them. Because when they borrowed all this gold and so on, that gold eventually became the Egel HaZahav. So it doesn't sound like it all worked out all that well. And the other thing which is strange, if they bothered the clothing, right? What kind of clothing do you think they borrowed? right? I mean, what did they do with their neighbor's miniskirts and so on? I mean, why, right? Put two or three of them together. Again, it's also a little funny, which is going to lead us to this other point about clothing that we're going to come to soon. But if they borrowed the clothing, they borrowed money, and they borrowed other things, which essentially is payment. The Gemara tells us that one day, and this is just this comes in the news every couple of years as well, but the Gemara tells us in Sanhedrin that one day the Egyptians said, hold it a second, the Jews borrowed all our things, we want it back. And the answer to the Gemara, and the Gemara really is that, okay, we'll give you back all the things we took, but we want you to pay us for all the years of servitude that we had. Which basically is what God did. I'm going to pay you for the servitude. So all the Jews were busy collecting all of these things, except for one person. And who was that? It was Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe is going, and it says that he's looking for Yosef's remains, but he had no idea where to find it. So according to the Midrash, who does he ask? He asks Sarach Bat Asher, and she tells exactly where to find Yosef. So again, she sort of like slips in over here. So it sounds to be that she is this elderly, wise woman. And by the way, she appears other places in Midrashim in the future as well. I'm just giving two places that she appears within Mitzrayim. There's actually a delightful Midrash. I found a version of it in the Torah Shlema, which is quoted from the Midrash HaGadol, which is a Midrash found in Egypt. There's another version of it which is found in the Seder HaDorot, which goes back to last 2 weeks ago. It says that when the brothers came back from Egypt, Canaan, and Yosef was still alive, and had to tell their father Yosef was still alive, so how do you go about doing that? What exactly do you say? So it says they were a little worried. The version in the Midrash HaGadol, they're worried that if they just walk in and say, Dad, guess what? Yosef is alive. He's in charge of Egypt. That they'd give him a heart attack and kill him. So, you know, how do you go about doing it? So the Midrash in Midrash HaGadol says that they asked Sarach Bat Asher, who at that point presumably was a young girl. So she waits for Yaakov to stand up and daven. So I guess he's in the middle of davening. And she starts to sing. Singing is, I'm also using some other version. But it sounds like she's singing because it's in rhyme. And she says, I'm quoting from memory, Yosef chai b'mitzrayim v'nolad al birkayim menashe v'ephraim. Something to that effect. I'll read to you from the Seder HaDorot. It says, V'nei sarach bat asher yotzeit likratam v'narach chachma v'yod'at l'nagen b'kinor V'yetnu la kinor lemar bona lefnei avinu v'yashaf lefanav v'hach bekinor Yosef dodi chai v'chihu moshel b'chol eretz Mitzrayim v'tosef et nagen ad kedivrim eila v'yishma Yaakov divrea v'yarev lo v'tavoa simcha b'libo v'no'am divrea v'tihi alav ruach elokim v'yada ki divrea nechonim v'yavarech Yaakov et Sarach b'dibra b'ti al yamsho mavet bach ad olam. And according to Midrash, she goes and then she lives forever. That Sarach Bat Asher either never dies, other places say that she goes into heaven without any sin, goes into Gan Eden, she's one. So she really is considered, you say, Nashim Tzadkaniyot, so I'm just pointing out that she may be one of the greatest Tzadkaniyot that we had, which again, minor character in this whole thing. I do want to point out that the way that I understand that Midrash, Yaakov at this point has no Ruach HaKodesh. Right? He has no nevuah. That's what we talked about last week. And instead, what happens? He hears his granddaughter singing to him this nice song, saying Yosef is alive, and Yosef is in charge of Egypt, and Yosef has children, and so on. So what would you call that if this girl is singing? What would you call that in Hebrew? My wife didn't like this. I said it in Shul this Shabbos. Everyone else liked it. She didn't like it. I liked it. So I'm saying it again. What is that? It's a bat kol. Literally, it's a bat kol. It's a kol of the bat, which means, what's a bat kol? When there is no nevuah, when there is no ruach hakodesh, and you hear the sound of something. So I'm saying, that's what I think exactly the Midrash is saying, is that Yaakov hears a bat kol saying that Yosef is still alive. Yaakov then gets happy, then the joy comes back, and at that point he comes back to nevuah. But what's the first stage of coming back to nevuah? He hears a bat kol. What's the bat kol? It's the kol of the bat. Who's the bat? It's Sarach Bat Asher. She's the one who knows the nigun of geula. She's the one who knows the tune of the geula. With apologies to Barb Marley, I can say she knows the redemption song. She knows exactly, you know, how to sing about this Geula which is coming. So when the Midrash tells us that is Serach Bat Asher as a young girl, so how surprising then is it all those years later, when it comes to the time of Geula, Moshe comes in. Is he a pretender? Is he the real thing? Who do all of them go to? They go to an old woman. But this old woman, when she was a young girl, she's the one who knew how to redeem Yaakov from the death of Yosef. So then it's very interesting. She's the one who says Moshe's the real one, and she's the one who knows where Yosef is. She seems to be this old woman who knows everything, and she's this tzaddikah that, according to the Midrash, ends up going to Gan Eden completely alive. So as I said, when it says, B'zchut nashim tzadkaniyot, so I think of Serach Bat Asher, even though she's never mentioned in the Chumash in this particular context. So you like what I said about the Bat Kol or no? Yes or no? Mm-hmm. I like it. And that's what's important. Okay. So, why do I say that? I said two things unexpected. Because whether we like it or not, the Chumash does not have women all over the place. It generally does not have women as the main major protagonists. It generally doesn't have the women who are really actively doing things. And that is what happens over here. Okay, so I'm saying, I don't think there's any two ways of looking at it. There's actually, you know, there are more righteous women, the ones that are mentioned. So, for example, who else do you want to talk about? The Shifra and Puah. It's actually machloket, whether they're Jewish or not. I know you're going to tell me that it's Miriam and Yocheved, of course, but there's actually machloket who they are. When it says, how are they called in the Chumash itself? They're called the midwives of the Jews. So the question is, are they Jewish midwives or are they midwives of the Jews? And by the way, if they're not Jewish, it's even more impressive. The other person who's very impressive in the whole story is the daughter of Paro. We talked about her a couple months ago, right? We compared her with Hagar. So she also becomes very impressive as being, you know, having a hand in literally taking Moshe out from the Nile and saving Moshe. There is another midrash that I want to mention, and then we'll come back to the other issue. The other midrash deals with Yocheved. According to the midrash, when Paro made the decree that all of the Jewish men or boys will be thrown into the sea, it tells us that Amram said, it makes no sense to bring children into such a world. Are you familiar with this? You've heard this midrash. So he says that it makes no sense to bring children into such a world, and it says that he separated from his wife. And his daughter, Miriam, comes and says that you're even worse than Paro. Right? Paro, this part didn't make into the Haggadah Shel Pesach, that Paro only wanted to kill the males, and because of you, there won't be any males or females born. So you're worse than Paro. So then he decides to end up getting together and remarrying his wife. Right? So I found a source, right? You've all heard that story? I found a source that may actually hint at it in the text of the Chumash itself. Because the Chumash doesn't say it. It actually talks twice about the marriage. Once it says, Vaylech Ishmi Beit Levi, and he married a Bat Levi, that's not the one I'm talking about. In Perek Vav, Pasuk Kaf, it says, V'yikach Amram et Yocheved Dodato lo le'isha. V'teil lo et Aaron v'et Moshe u'shnechei Amram sheva u'shloshim ma'at shana. So Amram goes and he marries Yocheved, his aunt. How does this fit in with the previous place? It says somebody, Mishavet Levi, married Bat Levi. So therefore, it's his aunt. What's the problem with marrying your aunt? In Jewish law, you're not allowed to. So it's a little uncomfortable to say that Moshe, and for that matter, Aaron and Miriam, were all the products of a relationship which was technically in Jewish law would be considered to be the type of an incestuous relationship which is not allowed, and therefore, as I said, a little disturbing. What would be the counter-argument for that? The counter-two. One is, it's before Matan Torah, so don't bother me. Right? It's before Matan Torah, and then, you know, basically all bets are off. What would be other counter-argument to this? Is just like we saw regarding the lineage of Yehuda, the lineage of Mashiach coming from Yehuda and Tamar, and all of these illicit relationships, including Lot and his daughters, including where Ruth comes from, that, you know, as we spoke about then, by Yehuda, that God uses kelim shvarim. God uses broken vessels. God uses relationships which are not necessarily kosher in order to produce the best possible results. And therefore, to say that Moshe comes from some type of an illicit relationship maybe is not as troubling. You know, again, this is the kind of thing, and I mentioned this last time, I think, that in the New Testament they go, well, you know, out of the way to make sure that, you know, you have an immaculate conception and so on, so that there's no kind of relationship, forget an illicit relationship. And when you look at the actual lineage of Mashiach, you find the opposite. To say then that Moshe fits into the same type of category, so maybe it's not disturbing. Maybe it's not disturbing at all. Now, what does this have to do with the midrash of him remarrying his wife? So I noticed in the Targum Yonatan, which if we're intellectuals, we shouldn't call it Targum Yonatan because most likely it's not. It's the pseudo Yonatan, pseudo Jonathan. The publisher made a mistake and wrote Targum Yonatan, where originally people think it just said Tuf Yud, Targum Yerushalmi, or from Yerushalayim, or from Eretz Yisrael. But anyway, it says here, I'm reading the Targum now on that pasuk. V'nisiv Amram, what does Nisiv mean? He got married. Amram married. V'nisiv Amram. Yat Yocheved, he married Yocheved. Now the next word should be Dodato. What does Dodato mean? His aunt. So instead it writes, Yat Yocheved Chavivte. Yocheved, the one that he loved. It says, hold it. It says, from something I have and you don't have. Yocheved Chavivte. Yocheved, the woman that he loved. Why is it translated, the woman that he loved? So you remember in Shir HaShirim it talks about the Dod? The Dod in Shir HaShirim is the beloved. So it's not translating Dodato as his aunt, it's translating it as that Amram married the woman that he loved. By the way, that itself is very nice and very romantic. You know, you would say, no, this was a shidduch and so on, they never met before. No, it says he'd married the woman that he loved. So why is it stressing the woman that he loved? So what did I want to answer? Did you get it? Is that he was already married to her. Meaning, the Midrash, it says that he was married to her and separated from her. Where is the textual basis for such a Midrash? So it says over here that Vayikach Amram, what is Vayikach? It's Lashon Lekicha Kiddushin. He goes and he remarries the woman that he already loved, that he had separated from. And he separated from her because of the decree to kill all the children. So again, who's the one who gets credit for that? So it ends up being the credit goes to Miriam. Of course, there's a negative to all this, which we're not going to talk about. And that is that Miriam gets therefore very, very upset when Moshe separates from his wife. Remember? And therefore she gets involved in all of this. Which means Miriam getting involved and Moshe separating from his wife has to be read together with Miriam being upset when her parents separated. Because what's she basically saying to Moshe? You know, if I would have let our parents stay separated, you never would have been born, so therefore you should be listening to me, and how dare you separate from your wife. The only problem is that God doesn't like what Miriam said over there, so that's part of, as I said, a whole other discussion. So, with that whole introduction, now let's go to our other unlikely redeemer. Now, who was the first unlikely redeemer? It's all the women. All the women, or some are our people, as I said, don't get upset with me for this, but women are generally, we don't find them getting primary space in the headlines. And over here, when Chazal say, no, Bishut Nashim Tzadkaniyot, there was Gula Mitzrayim, so I'm looking at the text, it's black and white. It is the midwives, and it is Moshe's sister, and it is Moshe's mother, and it is Paro's daughter. It's all the women are involved in this. So I'm saying on a midrashic level, there are other things to look at as well. And absolutely should be looked for, because Chazal over here are not just making it up in order to, you know, to make somebody happy. This is absolute what's in the text. Now, the other person who has something to do with the Geula, and over here it's a little more complicated, because all of us know that when it comes to Pesach, when it comes to the Haggadah, when it comes to telling the story of the Geula, we go out of our way to say as little about this person as possible, almost taking him out of the Haggadah. And of course, who is that? Moshe. Moshe. I mean, it's a little funny, take Moshe out of the Haggadah. But you realize Moshe's almost not there. Within the whole, he's there, but almost not there. Try to read through these parshiot without mentioning Moshe at all, it's absolutely impossible, but nonetheless, we tell the story. Moshe gets really, really marginalized.
Is it to make it more about the nation?
could be to make it more about God. I mean, the funny thing is when he says that lo yade malach, v'lo yade sraf, v'lo yade elach, kodesh baruch, v'chvodo v'atzmo, that whole pasuk, is not talking about the ten makot, it's not talking about Yitzhak Mitzrayim, it's only talking about makat b'chorot. So it's funny that we take a pasuk about makat b'chorot and then we use it as an attitude for the entire redemption. Okay. There's a very famous midrash which is elusive. Elusive, by the way, is a euphemism for I can't find it. But there's something similar enough that maybe we'll look at. The elusive midrash, which all of us know and all of us, have heard at some point, is the Jews were redeemed. Okay, now forget about the women, forget about the other things. The Jews were redeemed that despite having lost all kinds of tradition, there were nonetheless three things that they retained. Do you remember what those three things are? Their clothes. Their names, and their language. Okay? That's the way that we remember this midrash. We'll see that it actually has a source, although the source does not precisely say this. But let's take a look. Source number one, Bitzeti Yitzro Mitzrayim. Amar Reb Elazar HaKafar. Bizchut Arba Devarim Nigalu Yisro Mitzrayim. Shelo shinu et shemam. What does that mean? They never changed their names. Velo shinu et lishonam. They didn't change their language. Velo gilu et mistarin shelahen. They did not reveal their secret. We don't know exactly what that means in this context yet. Velo hayu prutsim ba'arayot. And they were not involved in sexual sins. By the way, you notice in this midrash, one thing is missing. Which one is missing? Clothing is missing. But it added two more. Lo shinot shmam, they didn't change their names. L'Reuven, eil mishpacha Reuveni. L'Shimon, eil mishpacha Shimoni. Kinachtin Reuven v'Shimon, when they arrived, they were Reuven v'Shimon. V'chiselkin, and when they left as Reuven v'Shimon. V'lo shinot l'shonam, sheyim esaprum l'shon ha-kodesh. Shenemar beit Yaakov me'am lo'eis, haita yudah l'kadsho. They retained their language as it says, that God removed Beit Yaakov me'am lo'ez from a nation that speaks a strange language. L'lashon ha-kodesh alo, they remained their lashon kodesh. V'lo gilu misterin shalahem, they didn't reveal their secret. At motzei she'dibor ya mufkad etzlam shneim asar chodesh amar lehem v'shala isha mash bishkanta. V'lo yah behem isha gila et ha-dibor. For 12 months before they actually borrowed the things from their neighbors, they knew about this, that they're going to be leaving and they'll be told to borrow it, and nobody revealed, that's the secret. They didn't reveal the secret. That was the secret that they all had. V'lo hayu prutzin ba'arayot, and they were not sexually sinful, which, by the way, I will point out, is generally a condition that takes place within a slave culture. Unfortunately, within a slave culture, people's personal autonomy is one of the things which is compromised, and within slave cultures, you end up having a great deal, first of all, of rape, a great deal of promiscuousness, a great deal of people using sexuality in terms to barter to try to get more. So one of the things that you would expect in a slave culture would have been a great deal of sexual promiscuity, and what we end up finding, this is what the Midrash is stressing, is that no, that was not the case, that the Jews kept holy in that particular sense, and it brings us proof to this. Achat haita behen, there was only one woman, v'kadosh baruch hu pirsama, and that got publicized. V'yetzei ben isha yisraelit u ben ish mitzri. It says that there was this Jewish woman, and she had a son of a mitzri. It says no, this was the only one. V'shem imo shlomit b'divri l'matedan, misha amar v'yal ha'olam, mi'id she'ein b'Yisrael elahu. He was the only child produced from a relationship between an Egyptian and a Jew. That's at least what the Midrash insists. So, two things about this Midrash. One, Midrash said names and language, did not say clothing. Midrash threw a couple other things in there which we generally don't know. You all understand exactly why nobody taught you this Midrash in elementary school and they preferred to teach you clothing. because it's a lot easier talking about clothing than it is talking about sexuality. Correct? I mean, I'm just saying, it's that it's very clear to me why this entered the Jewish consciousness and not what the Midrash actually says, and that's because it's just not age appropriate for when most people actually learn the material. The Meshech Chachma says something interesting regarding these three or four different things. He writes, but before I get to the Meshech Chachma, I do want to add one thing. I also sense within this whole teaching something which I think a lot of, I say, not only do they not mention certain things, they did teach other things, because I think it's a very appropriate lesson that a lot of Jewish educators at a lot of points in history may have felt they wanted to say. I mean, just again, just imagine 20th or 21st century American educators talking to their kids, you know, you don't have Jewish names, and you don't speak Hebrew, and you dress like non-Jews. And again, you can see how educators would love to give this kind of message, and therefore you can throw it within, this is why the Jews were saved, and look what's the matter with you. You really can see a whole rant developing off of this, so now you understand another reason why people would love this. The Meshech Chachma, do you know who he is? The Meshech Chachma was Meshech, actually stands for Rav Meir Simcha HaKohen. Rav Meir Simcha HaKohen from Dvinsk. According to what I understand, he wrote this book when he was 17 years old, and it was so impressive. His father said, don't publish it, because everyone will only think that you only know about Chumash. Wait till after you write some more serious things. He later on wrote another book, the Or Sameach, which he wrote on the Rambam, and as far as I understand, he never published this in his lifetime. Rabbi Cooperman from the Mechala, he was the one who published the important edition of the Meshech Chachma, and I think he did more for publicizing it than anyone else. Meshech Chachma writes in Source 2, V'lakachti etchem li la'am, zeh shaloshinu l'shanam shayu mikavim la'gula ulu imuta atida, v'limdu zeh mi Yosef sha'am godel sha'im, she'im godu chashivoto b'mitzrayim, nemar bo, and so, okay, let me just explain what he just now said. He said that the idea, the command, that they didn't change their language or their names or arguably their clothing was Yosef's idea. See, there's actually a very strange counter to all of this. What is the counter? All of you have learned a teaching at some point that says that the Jews sunk to the 49th level of Tumah. Yes, you've heard of such a thing? When the Beit HaLevi quotes this, he says, I don't know where it's written. There's no Midrash that says this, no Gemara that says they went to the 49th level of Tumah. It is found in the Zohar. So they sunk to the 49th level of Tumah, and God had to throw them out. Again, this, at least the way the Beit HaLevi quotes it, they were supposed to live for 400 years. Why did we get out after 210? So was it because we were so good? So Beit HaLevi says, no, the opposite, we were so bad. Is that we would have stayed any longer, there wouldn't have been any Jewish people to save. We basically completely, now, what's the next word that I want to say? Assimilated. See, hold it a second. How assimilated were we if we were wearing our own clothing and so on? You know, sometimes people talk about how to stop assimilation, how to stop intermarriage. The best thing to do, make all Jewish men wear Hasidic clothing. Can you imagine walking into a bar wearing Hasidic clothing? You're not getting so far. I'm kidding about that. But if they retain their clothing, their names, and their language, so then what kind of assimilation are we talking about? Although I'll also ask a little differently. If they kept all those things, then what didn't they keep? So you can say they didn't keep Shabbat? Like from where the Ramban has a whole, maybe we'll look at this Ramban. Ramban has a whole claim that they had certain Sfarim and they had their own notes and they knew about Shabbat. They knew what didn't they keep? Yeah. Yeah. They're still wonderfully assimilated, aren't they? You should see the rest of the Meshech Chachma over here. Because he's definitely dealing with the cusp of nationalism. I don't want to use the word Zionism because, you know, someone could get upset. But he is dealing with the issue. Look at Source 3 in the Meshech Chachma. This is for you. I wasn't sure why I put it here because I wasn't going to quote it. Look at Source 3. V'atem lo totzi ish mipetach beito. This is Meshech Chachma, Perek Yud Bet. By the Korban Pesach, no one should leave the houses. Hinei ha-mitbonen yiraki b'mitzrayim nishtakach mehem gufo Torah. Shu'u goyim mekerev go. They forgot about the main laws of Torah. And therefore it says, halalu avdei avodah zarah v'halalu avdei avodah zarah. Right? We see that by the splitting of the sea. The angels complain, why are you saving the Jews? These are idolaters and these are idolaters. So I want to stop right there. According to the Midrash then, maybe they wore Jewish clothing, but they were idolaters. I mean, that's the important thing. They didn't believe in one God anymore. V'chein hefru brit milah. And he also quotes the Yalkut that says, Yalkut Shimoni, that they stopped doing brit milah. Now, brit milah, that I can argue, really is the one thing that they should have known. Right? That's bad. That's not like the insistence of somebody in Chazal to say that that Avram Avinu kept Pesach, right? Because he had Ugot, so maybe Ugot means Matzot, and maybe Avram kept Pesach. To say Avram kept, can you all agree with me right now? To say that Avram kept Pesach may be a stretch, can you agree with me? But to say that Avram kept Brit Milah, is that a stretch? So to say the Jews in Egypt maybe forgot to keep Pesach anymore, that you know, that doesn't bother me one way or the other. But to say that the Jews in Egypt may have stopped keeping Brit Milah, that would be a little bit more disturbing. That's what the Yalkut says, and that's what the Meshech Chachma quotes over here. Amnam hasyagim v'gderim shamru b'yitron gadol. They did keep siyagim and gdarim, which means there's certain things that keep you different. So the Meshech Chachma over here is being consistent in these places. He's saying that Yosef, in his wisdom, commanded the Jews, whatever you do, keep your Jewish clothing, keep your Jewish names, keep your Jewish language. Why? Because otherwise there would be no Jewish people to save a couple of hundred years later, or how far it really was from Yosef. Yosef is saying, forget about Brit Milah, forget about this. There are plenty of people who are circumcised. There are plenty of people who do this. Plenty of people take a day a week off. In order for the Jewish people to be around, you need these kinds of siyagim v'gedarim. You'll find that gilu mistarim is there instead of clothing almost every time. Lo kein begalut bavel hayu shomrim gufei Torah amnam hasyagim v'gedarim avaru. So he says that if you look at the time of when the first Beit Mikdash was destroyed, they went to galut bavel. There, they kept the laws themselves. It was just all the gedarim and the siyagim they didn't keep. And that really poses the challenge. So this idea of how to keep a people around, he's giving credit to Yosef for being the one to figure out exactly what is the strategy. You know, sometimes students ask me, on Shabbat, somebody came for Shabbat, and she asked me, I think I'm going to Binghamton next year. So do you think it's a good idea, a bad idea, which I don't want to get into the whole discussion of her personal life. But a kid going off to a secular college in America, how in the world do they go and keep their Jewish identity? So Yosef would say, keep your clothing, keep your name, keep your language, meaning keep your separateness. Because if you don't keep your separateness, then you will end up assimilating. Again, that's exactly the point. I mean, I would personally tell students, before you go, make a red line. Make your own red line. I'm not going to make a red line for you. Make your own red line as far as what you think, you know, you should or should not be doing. And when you find yourself crossing the red line, decide beforehand what you're going to do when you cross that line. Maybe it means get on the next plane and come back to Israel, or, you know, get re-indoctrinated. But Yosef had this problem. Yosef is the leader, and Yosef sees they're going to be here a long time. What do we do? So the Meshech Chachma gives this credit to Yosef for figuring it out. Source number, looks like it got messed up here. Source number two again, Vayikarab at the bottom of the page. It's really the same Midrash again, although what's interesting over here, if you look on page two, Rav Huna b'shem Rav Chiya bar Abba Sara yarda leMitzrayim v'gadra atzma min arayot v'nigduru kol anashim b'zchuta Yosef yarda leMitzrayim v'gadra atzma min erva v'nigduru kol anashim b'zchuto. So what did this part of the Midrash say? That the reason that they kept themselves pure sexually was Maasei Avot Siman LeBanim of Sarah and Yosef. Sarah's withstanding the situation with Paro, then stands as a maaseh avot simon lanim for all the children. Continue in the next line. Rav Chuna b'shem bar Kappara b'shvil arba devarim nigalu Yisro mimitzrayim al yedei shelo shinot shmam v'lo shinot lishonam v'al yedei shelo amrum lashon hara v'al yedei shelo hayu bahem parutz erva. But what's interesting that they skip a line. They went down as Shimon v'Levi. And how did they go out? Lo, they went out as Shimon v'Levi. Lo yukorim l'ruven rufis Yehuda, Luliana, Yosef, Listus, Alexandra. So what do you know about this Midrash now? that's being said during the Greek times when there are Jews taking Greek names. So I, just like I said, that you can have somebody, an educator, sitting and talking to American students today and say your name should be Yocheved and not Jessica, and your name should be, you know, Pinchas and not Paul. Over here we find that exact Midrash being taught, and it's using Greek names as its example, which I guess tells you a little bit also about the climate. Other examples of the same teaching is found in the next couple of sources in Midbar Rabba, and we will skip them all. Here is my question. Moshe Rabbeinu, who is the Goel, is that a fair thing to call him? He's the one that God chooses. He becomes the one to take the Jews out. So if the Jews are taken out, and by the way, for argument's sake now, I don't care so much about the authoritative Midrash. I'm more interested in the way that it gets passed down to us, and it does get passed down to us in terms of names, language, and clothing. As I said, clothing is the more mysterious thing, where it came from. Nonetheless, when we look at Moshe Rabbeinu, how does Moshe stand up against these three things? Which means, how does Moshe stand in terms of Jewish names, in terms of Jewish language, in terms of clothing? Does Moshe pass all of those with flying colors? Which one do you want to do first? We'll do clothing because it's the weakest and it's the easiest. I say it's the weakest in terms of its authority, but it's also the easiest. First, look at source number 6. This is something that was hinted at by the Meshech Chachma. L'chalamdecha ki shemeit Yosef, hifru brit milah. Umru niyeh kimitzrim. The Jews were the ones who said, let's stop keeping Brit Milah and let's be like the Egyptians. Of course, you realize the irony of that is that when Jews try to fit in, then God needs to send anti-Semites to say, as much as you're trying to fit in, no, you're not like us and we don't want you and you disgust us and so on. So over here, the beginning of Sefer Shemot, which tells us all those things, it's fascinating that the Midrash is saying the background of it is the Jews saying, let's stop doing the things that make us different, at least in terms of what God commanded the Brit Milah. I guess there's more Yetzer Hara in what God tells you to do than just what Yosef advises you to do. Okay, when Moshe shows up and he sees the daughters of Yitro and have the trouble by the whale and so on, what do they come and they say? They say they come back to their father. You know, what are you doing? He's a quick thing, whatever. What do the girls say? There was an Ish Mitzri who saved us. So look at the Midrash in source 7. But Tomarna and the women said, Ish Mitzri hitzilanu miyad haroim. There was an Egyptian man who saved us. So the Midrash asks, V'chi Mitzri haya Moshe? Was Moshe really an Egyptian? By the way, what could you answer to that? Was Moshe really an Egyptian? What answer could you give? I love asking rhetorical questions that no one answers. What could you give? You say, yeah, he was. He was born there. So what does it say? V'chi mitzri haya Moshe. El levusho mitzri v'hu ivri. It says, no, that Moshe was really a Jew, but he just dressed like an Egyptian. So again, I'm going to point out that if one of the reasons the Jews are saved because they didn't change their clothing, you have to admit it's somewhat ironic that the one who's going to lead them out is Moshe, and Moshe, unfortunately, is wearing Egyptian clothing. Now, you want to defend Moshe? What is he supposed to do when he leaves the palace stripped naked? And I mean, again, he's supposed to go shopping before he goes, runs away. He's running for his life. Like, what do you want from him? Oh, that's fine. I'm just pointing out that it happens to be that the impression that Moshe leaves on these women is that he's an Ish Mitzri. And the Torah says, Ish Mitzri is the one who helped us. But Moshe is an Egyptian. So what I'm beginning to raise is the appropriateness of Moshe as Goel, given the fact that he seems to be deficient in this particular area. Let's look at the next thing. The next thing that I'll talk about is language. On a number of occasions, when Moshe is asked to represent the people, he hesitates. Look in source number 10, the way that it's phrased. Perek Dalet, Pasuk Yud, Vayoma Moshe El Hashem, Bi Adoni, or it's not Adoni, Bi Hashem, Lo Ish Dvarim Anochi, I'm not a man of words, Gam Mitmol, Gam Milshom, yesterday, the day before, Gam Mi'az Dabrecha El Avadecha, Ki Kvad Peh, Kvad Lashon Anochi. So those words, Kvad Peh and Kvad Lashon, I would want to translate them as literally as possible. What does that mean? Kvad peh. What is Moshe saying? He says, I'm not aware, a man of words, which means Moshe seems to be talking about his lack of eloquence. Right? He's not a great speaker. Words don't flow off of his tongue. Right? There's some people who have that gift. Words flow. So what does kvad peh mean? I know you're going to tell me the Midrashim that he burnt his tongue and he had a speech impediment and so on. It's just not what it says over here. What does it say? Lo ish dvarim enochi. I'm not a man of words. Kvad peh. Literally, what does the word kvad mean? Kaved. What does that mean? It's heavy. Speaking doesn't come easy to me. It's a burden for me. Now, God says, God has all kinds of solutions for this. Who puts words, right, in the mouth of men and so on, right? God is essentially saying to Moshe, you know, we're going to do a little ventriloquism over here, and I'm going to give you what to say. And Moshe still protests. At the end, he gets Aaron to speak for him. Now, after all of that, all the pasuk we just now read is by the Sneh. If you look at source number 9, this is repeated twice in the next parsha, Perek Vav, Pasuk Yud Bet, and again Pasuk Lamed. Vayidaber Moshe lefnei Hashem. Moshe speaks in front of God. Lemor saying, Hein bnei Yisrael lo shamu elai. The children of Israel did not listen to me. Ve'ech yishma'eni paro va'ani aral svatayim. Now that's a very strange phrase, at least to me. Aral svatayim. He repeats it afterwards. Ve'yomer Moshe lefnei Hashem, Hein ani aral svatayim ve'ech yishma alai paro. I am aral svatayim. So just like we translated kaved peh as literally as we can, how would you translate aral svatayim? What does it mean to aral? What does it mean arilut? Okay, I'll help you. Is your silence a sense of modesty or a sense of...
Sealed.
Aral actually is the term which is used when someone is not circumcised.
Orla.
It's a very strange term to use in terms of aral svatayim. I am willing to say that Moshe's complaint over here is that he's not a fit representative of the Jewish people because he does not speak Hebrew. Moshe was not raised in a Jewish home. By the way, this is no fault of his own. I'm not saying that I blame Moshe for this. I'm just saying is that the way that things worked out, Moshe is not somebody who was raised in a Jewish home. Moshe was raised by the daughter of Paro. Being raised by the daughter of Paro, he was raised within the palace. Raised within the palace, Moshe's first language is going to be Egyptian. You can insist to me that he spent a little bit of time with his mother and when he was nursing and so on, but still, if I'm not mistaken, what Moshe is claiming over here is that his inadequacy as leader is because to be a leader, you need to be connected sociologically, you need to be later religiously, spiritually, with the people that you're representing. And it could be that Moshe says, you know, basically, I speak Hebrew with a miftah. Maybe some of us in this room can understand this. I speak with a miftah. How can I be the representative of the Jews in front of Paro? And I think that may be a rouse for time, especially when he already complained in the past about kaved peh v'kaved lashon, I find speaking difficult. So what's God said? Okay, so I have someone to speak for you. But I think Aral Svatayim is saying, how can I be representative of a people when I don't really speak their language? I'm not the right representative. Yeah.
Can you speak any Hebrew at that point?
As I said, it could go back to his very early years by his mother's house. But the whole problem of language, I think, is far more difficult than we sometimes, you know, until you start to think about it. But that's my sense, that the word aral svatayim is not necessarily the same thing as kvad peh. What's my best proof for that? I have two indications. One is, he said, I'm kvad peh. God said, I have a solution for you. Aaron will speak for you. When he again insists aral svatayim, it's the strangeness about aral which I'm looking at. And it's not the same phrase. It's a different phrase. And that's what makes me suspect this. Okay. So far. Moshe's clothes, again, not necessarily his fault, are not... I mean, if the Jews are saved because they didn't change their clothes, so Moshe's clothes of an Egyptian. If the Jews are saved because they keep their language, Moshe, again, through no fault of his own, doesn't necessarily have the language of the Jews. But the most serious of all of the things that I was going to say is really when it comes to Moshe's name. That's the most severe. let's take a look. Where exactly does Moshe get his name from? Do we have the exact pasuk over here? When look at source number 8. Perek Bet Pasuk Yud. Vayigdal hayeled, vativiehu levat paro, vayihila leven, vatikrashmo Moshe, vatomer ki min hamayim mishitihu. She names him Moshe, and she says, for I took him out of the water. Now, is that a good idea to say this, or not such a good idea? Can we all think for a second over here? What is Bat Paro trying to say when she says, I'm calling him Moshe because I took him out of the water? Do you remember a little bit of the background over here, what the Egyptians said? Paro said, take all of the Jewish children and throw them into the Nile. By the way, that wasn't the first idea. What was the first plan? First plan that he says is take all the Jewish males and kill them immediately. So that already gives you the indication of, you know, what Paro had on his mind. Kill all the Jewish males and let's take all the girls for ourselves. So basically, Paro has a way over here of filling up all the harems in Egypt with all the Jewish girls and let's kill all the Jewish men. And then we'll have no more Jewish people. What happens then? We're told that, again, going back to our first heroes. Who are the heroes? The women. The women who are helping them give birth, the midwives. They refuse to comply. And they give an excuse. No, the Jews are too quick, and the women, they didn't give birth without us, they don't need us. So what's Paro's second plan then? Second plan is, okay, so then take them after they're born and throw them into the river. And I want to again ask you something. If they're refusing to kill them, what sense does it make, okay, throw them into the river instead? Now, I could just say it's a technical thing, that when it comes to kill them right away, no, they give birth too quickly, but still, it sounds to be that that Paro perceives that there's a hesitation to kill them, so they throw them into the river. So we're missing something right now. But before I come back to what we're missing, what in the world is the daughter of Paro thinking? When she says, I found this kid in the river, what is she saying very, very clearly for everyone to hear? That Moshe is, in fact, a Jew. Meaning, this isn't a big surprise later on. Oh, guess what? Moshe's Jewish. Of course he's Jewish. We found him in the water. So if she wants to protect his identity, then why does she say this? Is this a good question? By the way, I'm also pointing out another thing. Even though you're all going to tell me, of course Moshe's a Jewish name. I know a lot of Jewish boys named Moshe. Who is the one who gives him the name Moshe? Paro's daughter. So is this a Jewish name or not? Actually, there are Jewish sources that tell us his real Jewish name. Anyone know? There's a Gemara that says Tuvia. Because it says that when he was born, it looked in Kitovu. It was Tuvia. Okay. So Moshe is an Egyptian name, but it's much worse than that. There's a pasuk from Yechezkel. Right, it makes no sense. Right, I didn't answer that yet. Look at source 16. It's from Yechezkel, Perek Kaf Tet. This is Haftarah for next week. Ben Adam is often the way that Yechezkel is referred to by God. Ben Adam. Sim panecha al paro melech Mitzrayim. I mean, put your face at Paro, the king of Egypt, vihi naveh alav, and prophesize concerning him, the al Mitzrayim kulo, and all of Egypt. Daber v'amarta, speak and say, ko amar Hashem Elokim, thus said the Lord God, hineni alecha Paro melech Mitzrayim, I'm on to you, Paro, the king of Egypt. Now, listen to the insult that God hurls at him through Yechezkel. Hatanim Hagadol, how would you translate that? The big crocodile. Harovetz Betoch Ya'arav, who slithers around in his river. Asher Amar, he who says, Li Ya'ori, the river is mine. Va'ani Asitini, and I created it. So this pasuk in Yechezkel reveals to us what the Navi understands to be part of the Egyptian mythology. And that is, Paro made claim to being the god of the Nile. By the way, without understanding this, you cannot understand all the plagues, and for that matter, most of the narrative which is coming up. When the Nile gets turned to blood, how do the Egyptians see? Again, the Nile is the life force of Egypt. The Nile overflows and irrigates the fields. What does Paro claim? That he is the god behind the life force of Egypt. He is the god of the Nile. Okay, as I'm saying, that's black and white in the pasuk over here of Yechezkel. What does that do for us? First of all, when they refuse to kill the children by hand, what is the solution instead? Take the children, throw them into the Nile. The Nile will then decide who will live and who will die. It's sort of like an ancient Sparta. So therefore, no, we're not telling you to kill anybody, just throw them in the water. Because they saw the Nile as something which was a living being, and the god of the Nile is Paro. Fine, throw the kids into the Nile will then determine life and death. So what exactly was the daughter of Paro claiming? She's a very good mother, by the way. And she's making a crazy claim. What is it? She is claiming that Moshe was given birth to by the Nile. That Moshe is a god of the Nile as well. Moshe, I took him out of the water. Moshe emerged from the water. Now, it could be, again, I don't know how to do a psychological analysis of people who have been dead for 3,000 years. It could be that the Egyptians didn't really believe this, and they just saw this metaphorically as symbolically. Or it could be they really believed it. By the way, I want to remind you of something. Her father claims he's god of the Nile, right? That's Paro. What does he name her? What's her name? It's actually not Batya exactly. What is it? Look at source 12. The Elu b'nei Bitya bat Paro. Shulakach married. But her name was Bitya. What does Bitya mean? The daughter of a deity. So Paro is a god. He sees himself as a god. I mean, that's the whole thing, that Moshe goes by the Nile and he sees him where he goes to the bath and whatever. He claims to be a god. What does he name his daughter? The daughter of a god. That's Bitya. So what does Bitya do? And this could either be the most cynical or the most brilliant, or maybe she's even sincere about it. What does Bitya do? She claims that Moshe also is a god. Moshe also is a god of the Nile. How is Moshe also a god of the Nile? The Nile gave birth to him. So she tells everybody, I took him out of the Nile. Which means as much as we're going to stand here and say, hold it a second. If she's admitting she took Moshe out of the Nile, what is she therefore admitting? She's admitting that Moshe is one of the Jewish kids who were thrown in the Nile, but that's not what she's saying. She's saying instead the Nile gave birth to this child, and therefore she's staking a claim of this Moshe to one day become a leader and take his place in the pantheon among the leaders of Egypt. Do you understand how brilliant she is, what she's doing? She is setting Moshe up the best career he can ever possibly have. And what career is that? To become a god of Egypt. What kind of god is he? He's born of the Nile. She is staking a claim of supernatural. She's staking a claim in terms of Moshe, in terms of being some kind of deity. And again, I'm going to now say, again, if we put all this together, what do we now realize? That Moshe did not have Jewish clothing, right? Ish Mitzri. Moshe did not speak the language, and that's why he insists Ra'al Svatayim. And all of that pales in comparison to his name, because his name not just is a name which is given to him by Paro's daughter, it's a name which is given to him deliberately in order to stake a claim of divinity, of being part of the Avodah Zarah of Egypt. But by the way, there's a very interesting Gemara which is almost impossible to understand. To claim that he's a god, part of the idolatry in Egypt. You have a question? Not Paro. They claim, yeah, this is like the Salem witch trials, right? If you're a witch, then you sink. Sorry, how does it go? If you're a witch, then you float. If you're a human, then you sink. So if you drown, then you're a human. And if you float, then you're a witch, then they kill you. That was the witch trials. Over here, it's a very similar thing. Any child who's born, throw them into the river, and the river will decide who lives and who dies. What would happen to all the kids? They die. Who's the only kid that gets saved? Moshe. So what is she claiming? She's saying, no, all the kids died. What is this? The Nile gave birth to him. Which means if you live in a culture, this is, by the way, the advantage of mass hysteria. If you live in a culture that everybody believes that the Nile really has power, and really believe that power is the king of the Nile, the god of the Nile, and then you say, well, the Nile gave birth to this kid. Oh, that makes sense. The Nile gave birth to this kid. So what do we have here? We have another god. She's claiming that Moshe is a god. By the way, not a Jewish god, which would be a hard thing to claim anyway. What is she claiming? She's claiming that Moshe is a god of Egypt, and he's an Egyptian god, therefore Moshe is... The name Moshe should be absolutely connected. Forget about that it's not a Jewish name. Right? The name Moshe should be absolutely 100% connected to Avodah Zarah, to idolatry. That's the problem.
Do they think he's a Jewish boy that was killed in the
Bible? Of course what you're saying is logical. What I'm saying is that once you get caught up into the whole culture of the Egyptian system, then to say, what she's saying, oh, I took him out of the Nile, what she is really claiming is just like a father is the god of the Nile, she's claiming the Nile gave birth to this child. And therefore Moshe is a god. So, I think our challenge is a little bit more profound than maybe we would have thought. It's not just that Moshe doesn't have a Jewish name. It's not, so I started to say the Gemara before. There's a Gemara in Chulin on page 139, Kuf Lamed Tet. The Gemara asks a very strange question. The Gemara says, Haman, I forgot the exact sequence, it says, Moshe min HaTorah minayin. How do you know there's be such a man like Moshe in the Torah? No, it's an absurd question. What do you mean, Moshe min HaTorah minayin? How many times do they say Moshe in the Torah? Okay, I don't know either, but lots. What do you mean, Moshe min HaTorah? Then it gives an answer. It says, Bishagam hu abasar. Actually, I think, do I have the Gemara here for you? Look at source 11. Moshe min HaTorah minayin. It says, Bishagam hu basar. How do we know there'll be such a man like Moshe? It says, Bishagam hu basar. That, what is Bishagam hu basar? Rashi here says, oh, Bishagam, begematria is Moshe. So that's how we know there'll be, well, the question makes no sense, the answer makes less sense. The next three people the Gemara asks about will convince you that this is all Purim Torah. The next three people it asks about, it says, it talks about Haman min HaTorah minayin. How do you know there ever be a Haman? So it says Hamin HaEitz. How do you know Mordechai min HaTorah? So then it says Mar Duror. See, very quick, it sounds like Mordechai. And then it says Esther min HaTorah minayin, and Yastir Stir Panai. The questions make no sense. The answer makes no sense. You know, if I were to say to you at face value, what is the connection between Moshe, Haman, Mordechai, and Esther? So what would your answer be? There's no connection whatsoever between the four of them. But let me point out a halacha that you may not know. The halacha is that you're not allowed to say the name of Avodah Zarah. We're not allowed, one of the, it says, you're not allowed to shame, the names of other gods you're not allowed to say. You can't say name of Avodah Zarah. There's one exception to the rule. If there's Avodah Zarah, which is mentioned in the Torah, then you're allowed to say it. So therefore, Pa'or, for example, am I allowed to say Pa'or? Yes, I can say Pa'or because it's mentioned in the Chumash. So, and that's, if I'm not mistaken, that exception is found in the Shulchan Aruch. What did Haman do to everyone? He made everybody bow down to him. Haman tried to turn himself into a god. So to ask Haman min HaTorah minayin is a very fair question. Does it say Haman? It says Haman HaEitz. Esther, you know, I don't know if you know this, but now is not the time to talk about it. I have to get closer to Adar. Esther, people suspect, is very close to Ishtar. Ishtar is a name of the idolatry. Mordechai is very close to Marduk. If I look at the three other people, Haman, Mordechai, and Esther, Haman, Marduk, and Ishtar, they're all names of idolatry. And then I suddenly get to the realization that maybe none of us realized before today, that the name Moshe may also be the name of an idolatry, the name of part of the Egyptian pantheon of gods. And that's precisely what Bat Paro was trying to do. She was trying to set her son up, to position him. Because think about it a second. In the palace, who's going to have the lowest possible significance? Or it would be the adopted son of the daughter of the king. So what if she claims instead, what are you talking, adopted son? He's a god. By the way, by claiming he's a god and the god of the Nile, he actually just now became actually the son of Paro, because Paro is the god of the Nile. So by saying that the Nile gave birth to him, she's actually claiming that he's a son of Paro. Okay, this, I may be going too far, maybe it's too much conjecture, but what's my point? Moshe doesn't have Jewish clothing, Moshe doesn't speak Hebrew, and Moshe's name is not a Jewish name. Moshe's name is part of the Egyptian idolatry. And I think that all of these questions, you know what rabbis always do, they turn questions into answers. So that's what we have to try to do now. So I think that all of this may actually be an answer and an explanation. While it's true that the Jews were saved because they retained their names, their language, and their clothing, which, by the way, basically means that they didn't assimilate, otherwise there would be nobody to save, the Jews are saved for all of those reasons. Moshe becomes the savior, not just despite the fact that he's lacking all those things, maybe even because he's lacking those things. And let me add one more consideration, and then we will end. When you're slaves, you tend to believe the narrative of the master race which has enslaved you. Somebody tells you every single day that you're terrible and you're weak and you're inferior. The real tragedy is when you start to believe those things. There was a risk that the Jews being enslaved in Egypt start believing all these negative things about them. And maybe even they felt that Paro really had great power, and maybe Paro really was this incredible... Again, especially if we're told that the Jews ended up assimilating in terms of belief, that they abandoned belief, maybe they start to believe whatever they're told in Egypt. They brought up in Egypt, they believe the Egyptian system. Now, what better way to leave the Egyptian belief system than to have an insider tell them that the whole thing is not real? Let me go back a step. Leaving Egypt does not include only geographically going from point A to point B. When you're a slave in Egypt, you also believe the whole narrative of the masters. Part of the narrative is that Paro is superior, the Egyptians are superior. So you know, like the best movie ever, The Wizard of Oz? When you pull the curtain and you see that the great and powerful wizard is just a man from Kansas? That's what Moshe does. Moshe pulls the curtain on Paro and says he's just a man like everybody else. Who better to tell the Jews that this whole idea of the Egyptian mythology is not true than a former god? Again, who has a better resume for that message than a former god, which means a former god within the whole Egyptian system, which means the irony over here is delicious. On the one hand, the Jews are saved because they didn't assimilate because they kept their name, clothing, and language. On the other hand, somebody who was the most assimilated, somebody who was brought up in the palace, somebody who has an Egyptian clothing, Egyptian language, and even Egyptian name to the extent that he's a part of their whole belief system, he's the one who turns the Jews and says no, pulls the curtain and says, this whole thing isn't real. Once Moshe is able to say this whole thing isn't real, then the Jews are able to leave Egypt, not just geographically, but also emotionally and psychologically, to be able to no longer feel about Egyptian superiority and Egyptian gods and Egyptian sensibilities and so on, because Moshe is the one, more than anybody else, who was set up by his mother to be a god. He's able to say, no, this whole thing is a joke. This whole thing is not true. There only really is one god, and that is the God of the Jews. Which means, by the way, the scary part of all this is if you try then to extrapolate from this, you know, start thinking, okay, who could be Mashiach today? And it ends up not necessarily being, you know, the candidates that we would think of, but it's like saying, like, I don't know, you decide what people worship. People worship rock stars? I don't know. Whatever it is that people worship, to have somebody coming out of that world saying, no, all of this is an illusion. All of this is fake. None of this is real. This is the only thing which is real. Which means in order to save the Jews, not just from the physical Egypt, but from the belief system of Egypt, therefore it was necessary to have Moshe, despite the fact that when it comes to clothing, language, and name, that Moshe was deficient, it was exactly his deficiency which made him so appropriate. Of course, for Moshe's part, he the rest of his life thinks that he's inadequate, which only makes him more attractive to us, correct? The whole time that Moshe thinks he's inadequate to be leader, we get more and more convinced that he's the right guy. It's the people who try to convince us all the time that they are the right people or the ones that we're a little scared of. You know, do they really have the right stuff or not? Over here, Moshe thinks he's completely inadequate. He thinks he doesn't speak the right language. His language is Aral Sfatayim. I don't have the right Miftah. I can't speak the language. I'm a foreigner. How can I represent the Jews? It's just wrong for me to represent the Jews. God says it's okay. It's okay. How can I be the one? I was, look at his name, Moshe. It's okay. And if I'm right about the understanding of that Gemara, and they have to ask Moshe Matar Minayin, of course you have to, if Moshe's name itself is connected with the Egyptian idolatry, you have to ask, why do you know such a thing? It's interesting, the Pasuk. What's the Pasuk? Bishagam Hua Basar. He's made out of flesh and blood. By the way, the rest of the Pasuk is he'll live 120 years. He's not a god, he's a man. And that's exactly what the Pasuk is pointing at. Moshe's not a god, Moshe's a human being. And there will always be a great tension on that, even among the Jews. And it's to our credit that despite the fact that Moshe separated from his wife, despite the fact that Moshe goes up for 40 days and 40 nights, doesn't eat and doesn't drink, despite the fact we don't know where he's buried, that we never went over that step and said, no, maybe Moshe's a god himself, or a demigod, or some kind of god. And the Judaism never made that mistake and just put a line to it. Moshe is a great human being, a great Navi, the greatest Navi we've ever had, but he's a man, flesh and blood. The person who sets him up for this, as we said, was Bitya. And at the end of the day, she didn't believe it either, as we know, that when the Jews left, we're told, in Devar Yamim, that she leaves with the Jews, and she goes and takes that great march towards Har Sinai, together with her quote-unquote son, with Moshe, and with the rest of the Jews. But as far as in the palace itself, she set him up for success in the palace, but that same success became the ability to convince all the Jews that the Egyptian mythology is just that mythology, and has no truth within it whatsoever.